Welcome to Stockwatch with myself, Nastasya Aronsa. Tackling your questions in studio tonight is Jean-Pierre Verster from Protea Capital Management and Dirkus Kombrink from Capricraft. Don't forget to send through your questions to us via SMS to 41392, email stockwatch at bdtv.co.za, or you can tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Let's start off with you, Dirkus. What did you think of today's market performance?
Lackluster, really. Didn't have a lot of direction from offshore, but I saw some decent volume coming through, and not all sectors firing on all cylinders at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we should expect from the rest of the year. Resources has had a run, platinum has had a run, and a few odd stocks really performing today. Sappy up a few percentage points. What was the other? I think platinum miner was up a few percentage points. So a few odd stocks seeing some decent gains. Mm-hmm. And it's good to see there's some buyers returning to stocks that, well, has been mostly neglected for the last year or two. So it's encouraging.
Jean-Pierre?
Yes, Nastasya, I must admit, I don't look too much at daily movements. I look at what shares move a lot, and I look at shares where there's a lot of news that comes out. So what piqued my attention today was EOH, obviously, at 9 o'clock. I was in there on the website, as most people clicking refresh.
So you're part of the reason the website crashed at some point.
Perhaps. But I'm also on the investor relations email list, as a few other people are. So thank goodness, got the email and saw the summary announcement. And I was actually a buyer of some shares, I would say that. Mm. I think that Stephen Fakuller is cleaning up the business, and that hopefully if they correct what is wrong, and there clearly is a lot wrong, then there is value. Sure, the profitability will be a lot lower going forward than what it was in the past, but hopefully it is more than sufficient to justify the current share price. Now, I said it with this with a bit of reticence, because, you know, the two big things in markets is greed and fear, and someone said recently to me, actually, it's hope and fear that are the two biggest risks in markets. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm hopeful that EOH will recover, but I'm hoping that that hope doesn't cost me too much money.
Are you also hopeful that EOH will be one of those star performers like it used to be back in the day?
No, I'm actually surprised that most of the clients have hang on to the company, so that's a plus point. If this is it, if it's 1.2 million in this one division and there's no other worms that, you know, crawls out of the woodworks over the next few months, sure, I think things stabilize. But what is the probability of that? Yeah. I think it's probable that there's some more, you know, worms that's going to crawl out. And I think there's a lot of upside from these levels. Mm-hmm. Limited downside unless clients start leaving them, which we haven't seen. The one thing that's keeping me on the sidelines is the Warren Buffett saying, you know, when a business with a bad reputation meets a management team with a good reputation, it's the reputation of the business that stays intact. But there is exceptions, but I'm still on the sidelines.
All right. You were talking a little bit about what to expect for the second half. From that assessment then, what do you think are some of the key themes that will likely be drivers for the second half of the year, whether it be local or global stocks?
Oh, in general, not for EOH?
No, not for EOH in general.
Well, almost had me sweating there. the market's already pricing in rate cuts all over the globe. So what we need to see is a flow through to high-frequency economic data, the PMIs, ISM, PMIs, manufacturing-type data. What we are seeing actually is a quite stable U.S. home market. You know, retail sales has doubled what was expected out this afternoon or this morning, actually, in the U.S. Most of their figures, if you look at small businesses and medium enterprises in the U.S., the sentiment is actually at a high there. So the U.S. economy, the bulk of where the job creation comes from, you know, it's from small and medium enterprises, they're doing quite well. How long that lasts without global PMIs picking up, I don't know. But what we might see in the second half is PMIs picking up from what was a terrible April or May, actually. I think all of May's figures were shock figures. You know, Trump tweeting that Sunday afternoon that they're going to impose tariffs within a week. I think that shocked business, not only the market. And sentiment figures will pick up in the next few months, unless there's some one or two surprises, from on the trade front that can derail what might be a recovery in the second half.
Jean-Pierre, second half, key themes you think will dominate?
Oof, my crystal ball is broken, Nastasha, but I would agree with Driekus that because interest rates have come lower and that wasn't expected, if you look at the sharp decrease in, for instance, the US 10-year rate, that has pushed the interest rate sensitive stocks like property and other yielding high yield shares quite a bit higher, so much so that we had the best first half in US markets for something like 17 or 18 years. So what I would be looking out for is whenever we have something that's very strong in a certain direction, is the phenomenon we get in markets called reversion to the mean. So as a pendulum of a clock swings left and right, the same in markets. So because you've got such a strong first half, it'll be interesting to see if maybe the opposite happens. If not in the second half, then people anticipating that it could be around the corner, perhaps even after the US presidential election, because it normally happens that politicians, especially incumbent presidents, try everything they can to make sure the economy is strong in the run-up to the next election, because that's what gets them voted back in for a second term. So I'm interested to look over the hill to see what could happen after the US election if there's too much stimulus to make sure the US economy stays strong, and then effectively, by extending the bull market, you precipitate the next bear market.
All right, so let's stay with you when it comes to the U.S. theme, because there is a question from Greg, and it's specifically for you, Jean-Pierre. He wants to know whether you have a view on Lockheed Martin and if it's worth in holding any existing U.S. equities in one's portfolio.
I haven't had a close look at Lockheed Martin. Obviously, they're in the defense sector, so they make, you know, planes and other weaponry for the U.S., and defense contractors have done extremely well. And there was a concern when Trump came in that he would pull all the troops from Afghanistan and all these places, and actually that there'll be less spending. But because he was quite abrasive in his international relations with other countries, actually international defense stocks have done quite well. So I don't have a view, and I haven't looked closely at the valuation. I'll put it on my list to look at it next time. But I know as a sector, it's one that has done very well, so I would just mention that.
All right, and the second part of that question: is it worth holding in? Is it worth holding any U.S. equities in one's portfolio?
Yes, I hold U.S. equities in my global fund. I believe there's a lot of value. They've been extremely strong. Some people say that, especially in the tech sector, some of them might be in bubble territory. I think there are specific ones that are expensive, but there are still a few ones that offer value. Facebook is my single largest position, so I still definitely see a lot of value in U.S. markets, but selectively, less so than the last 3 to 5 years.
No, the question is never should I own U.S. equities,
it's which,
or how much of my portfolio should be in U.S. equities. So the allocation is still about 50%, 55% of the MSCI World Index. So, you know, just looking at the index and looking at where most of the wealth was created over the last 100 years, looking at the culture around corporate governance and shareholder rights, the U.S. is where you want to be if you want to create wealth. So for sure, and if you're not willing to stomach a recession in the next 2 years, which is likely, that's a possibility. They've been warning about this recession since 2010. It will come one day, but you know, if you choose the right stocks and sit through that recession, you'll be fine, and even better off 2 or 3 years hence after the recession. So don't worry too much about getting the cycle right. If you do, great. You know. Kudos to you, but pick the stocks that you would like to sit, even if there is a recession.
I think tonight's going to be one of those shows where viewers are going to be asking specific guests to answer a particular question. And Driekus, this one's for you. It's from Luke. He says, could Driekus give a bit more detail on his investment thesis for Buffett Capital? I know it's been a regular stock pick of his. And then could the panel discuss their view on Pershing Square Holdings, the listed closed-end fund of Bill Ackman? So let's start off with the Buffett Capital.
I've owned Pershing Square as well. Lost a few bucks there, but I think he's getting it right at the moment. William Ackman, I've got a lot of respect for him. He went through a personal crisis just in the last 2-3 years, and I think he's about to turn the ship. Buffett Capital thesis is it's the biggest litigation finance company out there. If you go back to the 80s, it reminds me of what's the guys that do the infrastructure and forgot the name at the moment, it escapes me, but where they basically have financed out of their own equity lawsuits, litigation, civil lawsuits mostly, and because they're bigger than the rest, you know, that they can spread the risk. There's a lot of them out there. There's about 20 listed worldwide, but smallish, and you've got a lot of concentration risks. And these guys have a large team of lawyers with a lot of extra degrees and experience, and they evaluate these cases, and more than 90% of them they say no to. So, you know, they get to pick whichever case they like, which, you know, and that's why I picked Burford out of the sector, out of the global sector. Globally, the sector is expected to triple in the next, I think, by 2025. That is a enormous growth rate. I think they will capture most of that growth because what they've done is they've issued third-party capital at the moment. There's a sovereign wealth fund invested with them on which they earn an asset management fee and a performance fee. Mm-hmm. And they also have, you know, what you might call a fund, a unit trust fund, third-party funds, which investors can invest in, and they invest in these. That takes a while to allocate. And, you know, while all of this has been happening, the share price has actually been depressed. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the biggest holder of Burford Capital is the Woodford Income, and they've got two trusts. The Woodford Trust, you know, the big UK institutional investor that's seeing all these outflows because of the liquid stocks that he bought. Burford's actually one of the more liquid stocks that he owns, but it's one of his biggest holdings. So there's some selling pressure there. I don't know when it will let up, but when it does, I expect it to rewrite.
Jean-Pierre, do you have a view on Pershing Square Holdings?
Yes, I'll first say on Burford that the one issue I'm keeping my eye on is the increase in the receivables. So the cash flow has deteriorated in Burford. Still a great company. I also actually own some shares in it in my fund, but I'm keeping my eye on those receivables. Regarding Pershing Square Holdings, listed in Amsterdam, but managed by the US hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, I think he sort of lost his touch, especially with the Herbalife case. I think he got it wrong, and since then, it was a bit of a dent to his ego, and with a dent to his ego, I think the type of decisions he's made historically are different to the decisions he's made more recently in terms of taking larger positions, being very active and vocal about his positions. Here and there, I like some of the shares in his portfolio. There's a veterinarian company that I forget the name now of, but that's one of the stocks that I like. But it's still a closed-end trust, which means it will trade at a discount. And the only way you can really generate good returns for holders of those shares is to grow the NAV.
Trupanion.
And we wait for that to happen.
So. Trupanion. It's not Trupanion.
No, Trupanion is a different one. But people can Google it and they'll get to it. But so decent in terms of Pershing Square Holdings. But I'm neither here nor there for me.
And you're not going to pay a performance fee for a long time if you're in there at the moment, because he's way under the eye water mark.
All right. So the next question is from Anthony. He says, can the panel give their view on British companies?
In general, British companies.
Yeah, I think
in general. I must remind viewers that this is a live show. So it's one thing to get curveball questions about local shares, but, you know, when there are, call it 200 liquid local shares, but when there are 20,000 international shares, we won't always be able to answer.
All right, so this might help you. So there's an ask part that's actually just came through now. And he says, he elaborates a little bit more, your view on British companies, Capco, Hammerson, and Inter Properties.
Okay, so all three property companies. Things have been extremely tough in the UK property sector, been extremely tough for the UK consumer, and been extremely tough for shopping centres outside of the main centre, which is basically where all three of these play. Sure, Capco also has Covent Garden, but they also have a development area as well, Lily Square, which hasn't done great with all the Chinese and the Russians not buying as many off-plan units as they used to. Mm-hmm. So on all three, I know the share prices have come down a lot, but I still don't see value. They could continue going down because property companies, according to the tax law, have to distribute the vast majority of the income. It means they can't necessarily and naturally de-gear because they can't retain earnings. Mm-hmm. And you add to that pressure on the top line, it means they're getting less and less and less income, but the debt isn't decreasing, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Drukas, we're going to take a quick break, and then after that, we'll get your view on these particular companies. That's what we're going to do for now. So keep sending through your questions via SMS to 41392 or email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za. Welcome back. Taking a look at the market, starting off with things in the U.S. The Dow slipping after Donald Trump saying long way to go on trade with China. Looking at things in Europe, European stocks closing higher as investors monitor earnings, and Burberry shares up 14%. Still with me in studio is Jean-Pierre Forster from Protea Capital Management and Dricus Combrink from Capricraft. Dricus, we were with you at the views on those UK property companies.
I suppose it's a possibility that on Capco specifically there might be some corporate action, some value unlock over the next year or two. That's possible. So if you have Capco, hang on to it for that. I think Brexit has been, not completely, but to a large extent, being priced into some of these, especially locally listed counters. A lot of them, there's a smaller company called Stenprop that's transitioning into what they call a multi-let property company, where they have smaller factory type, warehousing type companies that plays into the e-commerce theme. And the capitalization rates and the escalation rate, actually, the escalation rates on those are much better than the rest of the property sector. In the UK and elsewhere for that matter. And the UK is a great e-commerce hub. So that's one that I would look at as a play there. But expect that if there's a hard Brexit and both Tory candidates is saying they're going for a hard Brexit, the market has started to price that in, that you're going to see some volatility in the short term. There's still a chance that they walk away from that. And then some of these shares are extremely cheap. But it's a difficult one to play. We've got some exposure here and there. Mm-hmm. We own Lloyds Bank for the last 4 years. It's been a pain trade. After Brexit, actually, we bought into Lloyds. And the thesis has been that they're focusing on the UK economy itself, which will take a hit, but most of their customers are small and medium enterprises, which once again has outperformed the rest of the economy. Yeah. So you get a basically 6-7% dividend yield with a 2-3% buyback yield. You know, they're buying back stock, so you're looking at 9% shareholder return just from, you know, prudent capital allocation. But you know, the share price has been depressed because you've got this banking crisis in the UK or in Europe, while you've got Brexit fears. But these things tend to blow over. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in the UK, but the short-term volatility is might be on the increase.
Yeah. On the SMS line, there's a question that says, the panel's view on Omnia and RCL.
So Omnia, I mean, we need to wait for the rights issue. And because they've signaled that they're going to do a rights issue, it's not great. It will be very diluted. And if you factor that in, the dilution, it's probably trading near fair value, but it's so sensitive to the actual price of the rights issue that it could be cheaper, it could be expensive, depending on if the rights issue price is closer to the current share price or far below.
Yeah.
At the moment, I would say the chances are it's below what people expect, and therefore that there isn't much value until we see the extent of the dilution. Mm. And RCL, unfortunately, their positioning of the business, they're in commodities in terms of sugar, they're in commodities in terms of chicken, and they've got some brands in their consumer division, but even bread, for instance, and other ones are sort of trading like a commodity these days as people look for value and rather buy, call it store-baked bread rather than the packaged bread, and that has impacted their consumer sector negatively. So on all fronts, RCL is really having a tough time as well.
Drickus?
RCL might have a bounce if you know, there's a proposal for tariffs again on chicken imports for the brown pieces, and if that goes through, you know, you might see a bounce, and RCL is still a substantive part of the business. But generally, I don't see any competitive advantage they have in anything. Same for Omnia. I don't see a lot of competitive advantages for them. They have buy a lot of their feedstock from what is essentially their competitors. So I'm not sure. Bad capital allocation in the last few years. I'm not sure things are going to change for them. No.
Okay. The next question says, the panel's view on Famous Brands. I see the stock is up from its recent lows.
I've been a long-standing fan of Famous Brands. It's a company with great brands, and they got it wrong with Gourmet Burger Kitchen. And some of the other local brands then sort of started to teeter as well, and they needed to take some write-offs from previous acquisitions that they made. But for me, the core brands, the likes of Wimpy and Steers and Debonairs, are so strong that I'm hoping that when we have a better consumer environment in South Africa, the pricing power of those brands come back. And as the franchise holder, that's really good for a franchise holder because they take a percentage of revenue of the franchisees. It means that they get hurt quite often before the franchise holder, as has happened. And when they get so hurt that the franchise holder needs to give assistance, as has happened, it means you see a decrease in profitability of the franchise holder. Mm. But the moment that turns, the franchise holder is happier and the franchisees are happier. And I'm waiting for those happy days, and hopefully the glass is half full in this regard rather than half empty.
Famous Brands?
A few years ago, I realized that these guys were doing the acquisitions, and I remember thinking that they are going to run out of decent brands that they can buy in SA. Yeah. They've bought some of the best, but they're going to run out of acquisition space, if I can call it that. Mm. That while the consumer was slowing down since about 2012, you could see the consumer starting to slow down, while a lot of these shares were still trading at 20-plus price-earnings ratios. And then they went offshore, like a lot of them did.
Yeah.
And almost 90% of them burned their fingers offshore. And nothing, you know, it's the same with Famous Brands, but I agree with JP, you know, it's I think it's excellent brands in their defensive business, actually. Mm. And if the consumer stops feeling the pinch on their wallet at the moment, they will frequent the brands more often. And Famous Brands doesn't really price any bounce in at these levels.
All right, Jean-Pierre, this one specifically is for you. Are you a fund manager of any specific unit trusts, or do you only run hedge funds?
Ah, okay, so an interesting question, because 3 to 4 years ago, the laws changed. So today, hedge funds are also unit trusts.
Yeah.
So you get traditional unit trusts, and you get hedge fund unit trusts, or as we call them, collective investment schemes in securities and collective investment schemes in hedge funds. But they're all unit trusts. They're all regulated by the FSCA. They all have certain risk parameters and exposure parameters that they need to deal with. So I do manage 3 hedge funds, but they're also unit trusts.
All right, so the next question is from Brett. And he wants to know the panel's view on whether Data Tech and Adept IT are buys at their prices.
So Adept IT recently bought back a large chunk of their shares, I think like 8% or something, which shows good capital allocation. And Data Tech as well has been on a almost 2-year-long share buyback program because they got so much cash after selling the majority of the business to Cinex, the Westcon business. So it's the same type of story in the IT sector, getting a lot of cash or having a lot of cash from previous deals and then using that to buy back shares when the share price is relatively depressed. And you've seen what that does to the Datatech share price. It's up, I think, 80% in the last year. Mm-hmm. And if Adept IT can continue with this with good capital allocation and their contracts are squeaky clean,
because
that's a lesson we learned from EOH. The whole industry seems to be questionable in terms of how business is won. So as long as that is the case, then both look interesting. But if they are clean, and I say they, I don't want to cast aspersions on the management. I just mean within the organization, the way they got business, because it might be an industry-wide problem, then my preference would be for Adept IT.
Drukas?
I think Adept IT has got some better businesses in terms of the survivability of the businesses or the competitive advantages that they might have. Datatech is basically box movers at the end of the day. There's not a lot of value add to what they do. Businesses that they run are recovering and they have exposure in emerging markets where demand for those products is set to increase. So not a dat, but I think Adept ID is a little bit more exciting than Datatech, and it's not pricing in any excitement. I think it's just part of the small cap universe that's been depressed and not trading at any demanding type of valuation.
All right. The next question is around Tencent, and the viewer wants to know, the Tencent that's listed in New York, is it worth a buy at these prices?
So the Tencent listed in New York is an ADR. We have some of those as well, American Depository Receipts, which mirrors the Tencent listed in Hong Kong, which is the actual share. But when I say actual share, that's actually the listing of a variable interest entity that's incorporated in Cayman Islands, and that has a contractual relationship with the actual business on mainland China. So it gets complicated, but wherever you buy it, whether it's in New York or Hong Kong, you are exposed to the Tencent business, in loose terms exposed, and the share price has come back a lot, the business is still doing well. I wouldn't call it cheap yet, so once again, I'm on the fence in terms of the valuation on Tencent.
Do you have a view on Tencent before we get to stock picks?
We own Naspers, so obviously we like Tencent. And the only bad thing is that 50% of Tencent is gaming, and we saw what can happen in the last year or two if that unit takes a knock. You know, it's but they are diversifying into other streams, while the gaming unit should recover in a short to medium term.
Let's stay with you for your stock pick.
Well, it's actually not a stock. It's a structured investment or a structured note, and it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange or on the ARC. It's called the IVOL Quadratic or the Quadratic Volatility Interest Rate Instrument. Mm-hmm. IVOL is the code. What it does, it longs interest rate volatility in the US, and it also has exposure to rising inflation rate. So whenever the yield curve steepens or inflation rises, or interest rate volatility rises, you should profit from either of those. So I like the asymmetric return profile of that, especially entering into a place where we've forgotten what inflation is.
Yeah.
It will return someday, if not tomorrow. And we've forgotten what, or the world has got a lot of negative yielding assets out there. And I think when the rhetoric changes to, well, all of a sudden there's some inflation, you'll get a double whammy there. You'll get a what they call a bear steepener in the price, you know, in the yield curve. You should Google this stuff, bear steepener, while interest rate volatility rises, while inflation expectations rises. So maybe a triple whammy for that one if the, you know, the view of the market on interest rates and inflation changes, and it can on a dime.
Yeah. Jean-Pierre?
My stock tonight is Air Canada. Mm-hmm. It's the largest airline in Canada. And I like airlines in general, especially in the US because it's an oligopoly. But in Canada, it's even better. It's moving towards a duopoly. Mm-hmm. So only two major players. Air Canada is looking to buy out a very small competitor of theirs. And the other big airline, WestJet, is being bought out by private equity, which would mean more debt and more responsible pricing. Now, the thing about Canada is they've got a few big cities, but they don't have the population density to really have a true hub-and-spoke system where a lot of airlines can compete.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of laws that restrict U.S. airlines from flying directly between Canadian cities. So because of those nationalistic laws, it creates a wonderful space for Air Canada to continue increasing their ticket prices, making a lot of money, and being a good share.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this evening. That's Jean-Pierre Forster from Protea Capital Management and Dricus Combrink from CapriCraft. We take more of your stock-related questions tomorrow, so have a good evening. Let's stay with you for your stock pick.
Well, it's actually not a stock. It's a structured investment or a structured note, and it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange or on the ARC. It's called the IVOL Quadratic or the Quadratic Volatility Interest Rate Instrument. Mm-hmm. IVOL is the code. What it does, it longs interest rate volatility in the US, and it also has exposure to rising inflation rate. So whenever the yield curve steepens, or inflation rises, or interest rate volatility rises, you should profit from either of those. So I like the asymmetric return profile of that, especially entering into a place where we've forgotten what inflation is.
Yeah.
It will return someday, if not tomorrow. And we've forgotten what, or the world has got a lot of negative yielding assets out there. And I think when the rhetoric changes to, well, all of a sudden there's some inflation, you'll get a double whammy there. You'll get a what they call a bear steepener in the price, you know, in the yield curve. You should Google this stuff, bear steepener, while interest rate volatility rises, while inflation expectations rises. So maybe a triple whammy for that one if the, you know, the view of the market on interest rates and inflation changes, and it can on a dime.
Yeah. Jean-Pierre?
My stock tonight is Air Canada. Mm-hmm. It's the largest airline in Canada. And I like airlines in general, especially in the US because it's an oligopoly. But in Canada, it's even better. It's moving towards a duopoly. Mm-hmm. So only two major players. Air Canada is looking to buy out a very small competitor of theirs. And the other big airline, WestJet, is being bought out by private equity, which would mean more debt and more responsible pricing. Now, the thing about Canada is they've got a few big cities, but they don't have the population density to really have a true hub and spoke system where a lot of airlines can compete.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of laws that restrict US airlines from flying directly between Canadian cities. So because of those nationalistic laws, it creates a wonderful space for Air Canada to continue increasing their ticket prices,
yeah,
making a lot of money and being a good share.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this evening. That's Jean-Pierre Forster from Protea Capital Management and Dricus Combrink from Capricraft. We take more of your stock-related questions tomorrow, so have a good evening.